we need a presence in the American democracy that is offering a solution to everyday people that is as attractive and also tracks with their experience as much as the solution that the right wing is offering so many people both here and around the world.
Hello, and welcome to the Practical Radicals podcast. I'm Stephanie Luce.
And I'm Deepak Bhargava. Today on the show, we'll talk about electoral change. A lot of people are cynical about electoral politics, but we're going to talk about how some organizations are making electoral work more strategic and more effective at winning transformative change.
We share some of the cynicism about electoral work, as we've seen our share of frustrating, at times enraging, electoral approaches. But we both come to this work believing that we cannot win the kinds of changes we want to see without engaging in the fight for governing power. You know, you only have to see how much money and time and strategizing the overdogs put into electoral work to see how important they think it is. If our votes don't matter, why do the overdogs fight so hard to take them away?
This week, here is far-right conspiracy theorist Jack Posobiec at CPAC in a panel hosted by Steve Bannon.
I just wanted to say, welcome to the end of democracy. We're here to overthrow it completely. We didn't get all the way there on January 6th, but we will endeavor to get rid of it and replace it with this right here. We'll replace it with this right here.
All right, amen.
That's right, because all glory is not to government, all glory to God.
What he was holding up there as a necklace is a cross necklace, is what I'm told, so you can't see it in that clip.
The far right is increasingly saying the quiet part out loud. Their vision for an end to democracy and its replacement with theocracy is frightening. But one thing that can be said for the far right is that they do have a clear vision. Their strategy includes an organizing plan to recruit new people to grow their movement, and an understanding of the essential role of electoral politics in advancing their vision. Among centrists and liberals, on the other hand, the standard model of electoral work is usually heavily focused on a candidate rather than a vision of a better society or a plan to build organizations. Electoral work in this model tends to be transactional and irregular, knocking on doors to get votes every 2 or 4 years. We think a better model starts with a vision, the ambitious goal of winning governing power, and then works backwards to develop a strategy to get there. So rather than focus on election day and candidates, a better model thinks about what policies can make an impact on people's daily lives and how electoral work can intersect with winning and implementing those policies.
We've seen some of these more strategic approaches at the state level, with groups such as the New Georgia Project Action Fund, which helped defeat Donald Trump in 2020, or LUCHA and a broad grassroots immigrant rights movement in Arizona, which organized against a vicious anti-immigrant political attack to turn the state blue. Sometimes we forget our history. Even California has not always been a solid blue state. After all, it was the state that brought us Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, and voters have passed a slew of conservative legislation in that state in the past several decades. Here's a flashback to the early 1990s when that state's politics were starting to shift and the disposable heroes of hip-hopracy covered the Dead Kennedys song, California Uberalis. I give the rich a giant tax loophole. I leave the poor living in a poop hole. At a time when AIDS is in a crisis, I cut health care and I raise prices. Sales tax, snack tax, excise tax, information attack with a newspaper tax. It's the pocketbooks of working families. Increased tuition at the university. Someday I'll come land all of you. Even your kids are gonna pray to me in school. Soon I'm gonna be the president. You might remember the last one this state sent. California, Uberalis, California. But underdogs fought back. Community groups came together in an alliance called California Calls to analyze power, organize and expand their base, and plan long-term. Labor unions also played a critical role in the transformation of the state. These groups are succeeding in part because they are finding ways to connect base building and electoral politics.
But of course, this work is hard and filled with tensions. We need to be realistic about the structural challenges and obstacles to winning governing power, from the Electoral College to the role of money and fundraising. Progressive coalitions have the best chance at winning seats at the local level, where door knocking and personal relationships matter more. But once you get to the state and national level, conservative forces have a huge advantage given their wealth and resources. Electoral work also means building a broad base. You need a majority to win. But this can create tensions when some in the community support more radical demands. How do you push the left edge of the possible while maintaining majority support? Another challenge is how to balance the slow, steady base building work, which takes lots of time and resources, with the fast-paced need for massive electoral turnout.
And of course, if you succeed, there's the new challenge of how to work with elected officials once they are in office. I learned a lot about this when I lived in Wisconsin and helped build an independent political party in Madison called Progressive Dane. We were pretty successful in getting people elected to city council, county board, and school board seats, but I saw how hard it was for them once they were in office. They had to do a ton of work to learn about the city, read new proposals, and sit through hearings. The right wing has built an enormous infrastructure to help politicians with this work, even crafting draft legislation. But progressive politicians are usually left on their own to do all of this work without any support. A better electoral change model would help these politicians to govern. On the next episode, we'll talk about the strategy of inside-outside campaigns, where social movement groups work with elected officials to draft legislation and get it passed, and make sure it then gets implemented.
But today, our focus is on building powerful electoral organizations and getting good people elected in the first place. One of the sharpest thinkers on electoral strategy is Maurice Mitchell, National Director of the Working Families Party. Maurice has been one of the most popular guest instructors for CUNY's Power and Strategy class at Leadership for Democracy and Social Justice because he's a consummate practical radical, holding an unflinching radical vision for the transformation of society with a sober and practical analysis of what's needed to actually get there step by step. We invited Maurice on the podcast to talk about his vision for building governing power in the United States. Maurice, thanks for joining the show.
It's good to be here.
So Maurice, it's so great to have you on the show today. And I want to just start out with the basics of what is the Working Families Party?
So the Working Families Party is a national political movement. And everything we do runs through the basic idea that we believe that in a democracy, the people should govern, not the wealthy and connected or corporations. And what we do is we attempt to take our very rigid first-past-the-post two-party system and find little fissures in it to make it easier for everyday people to truly govern. And we recruit activists, candidates, voters, organizations in a shared political commitment for the interests of the long-term governing of everyday people. Concretely, that has looked like us in states like Connecticut and New York using fusion voting, which allows for parties to be able to cross-endorse the candidates of others in order for there to be a Working Families Party line when you go and vote in the ballot, right? You actually can vote on the Working Families Party line. So we use that in the states that have fusion voting. I don't want to get into the details of fusion, but it's something that existed in every state. But then eventually the two-party duopoly came down on it, but it exists in some states that allow for minor parties to be able to really show up in constructed ways. Or we opportunistically recruit candidates inside of Democratic Party primaries, like we do all over the country, to support independent working families candidates in those open seats or in primaries against very, very right-wing or corporate Democrats. And in some cases, we run Working Families Party-only candidates. So the current Attorney General, Tish James, the Attorney General in New York, she started off as an independent Working Families Party candidate for city council. Jumaane Williams, who's the public advocate of the city of New York City, he started as an independent Working Families Party candidate for city council as well. And then currently, there are cities that have quote-unquote minority party at large districts, right? It's a very quirky system that essentially the Republican Party has benefited from. So in cities, Democratic cities, like the city of Philadelphia, where there's like a 7-to-1 sort of party affiliation, Democrat to R, Republican, we thought in a city like that, Republicans shouldn't just be able to waltz into having a representation on the city council. And so we challenged the Republicans to be the minority party. And so very recently, we were victorious, and Philadelphia is a two-party city, Democrat and Working Families Party. So suffice it to say, we do a number of things in order to, and we're very flexible, and we kind of cook what we have in the kitchen in a pretty rigid two-party system and in a landscape that makes it really hard for everyday people to show up in our democracy. We try to make it as easy as possible and use whatever tools we have to make that happen.
So Maurice, a lot of people today are turned off by electoral politics and are cynical that voting can result in positive change. And you've devoted your life to social change, but you've done a lot of different things. You've done organizing, you've done social movements. And in this chapter, you really made a commitment to electoral politics. Can you tell us about why you made that decision?
Sure. I started organizing as a young person. So, you know, I've been involved in social change at some level for most of my life. And I started off doing youth organizing. I went on to do campus organizing at Howard University. When I left school, I went back home to the South Shore of Long Island. I grew up in a multiracial working class community 20 minutes outside of Far Rockaway, Queens. And I wanted to begin to organize my community and to learn the craft of organizing. And I spent 7 years doing that, working on the hyper-local level, working with a number of communities across difference, bringing people together to work on educational equity, to work on tax fairness, to work on environmental justice. And then eventually what I recognized was that there were real limitations to how far we could go. And those walls that we hit were political walls, right? The walls that we hit were the legal regime that were preventing the resolution of these issues in a way that was satisfactory to the bases of people that we organized around. And so I started to get involved in electoral politics to actually change the people that we would be targeting, right? In a lot of traditional organizing, oftentimes your target are the elected officials, and we're outsiders attempting to apply pressure on the power. And so we wanted to change the face of the power in order to resolve the Campaign for Fiscal Equity lawsuit in New York, or in order to argue for a much more equitable tax system in New York. That's how I started to get involved in electoral politics relatively early in my career. Eventually, I learned the limitations of electoral politics, and I started to see how the lobbying that we were engaged in with some of the people that we got elected, how that also had limitations because our government is captured by organized capital, and whatever grassroots lobbying we were doing, you know, got almost completely ignored because you had sort of the professional lobbyists from the real estate lobby and the pharmaceutical lobby up in Albany being able to make deals in ways that we can never make deals. So again, I realized that capital was a real force that was very much setting the parameters of what was possible. And that realization, as well as just my outrage with the killing of Black people on our streets, really shifted my consciousness around figuring out, well, okay, if on the local level on issues, the wall that I hit was political, and then through my political advocacy, the wall that we hit was this intense corruption and the corporate capture of our government. What's above that? And I remember following the Zimmerman case where Trayvon Martin's killer didn't have to face justice at all and basically was able to walk free. The rage that I felt, I was crestfallen. I organized a mass mobilization and a huge protest. And I felt a sense of emptiness after that protest because I realized nothing changed. And I had made a commitment to myself that following that protest, if I had another opportunity, I wanted to lean deeply in, more deeply in, to doing everything I can do in order to make sure that a family or a community actually is able to experience justice. And then not too long after Trayvon Martin was killed, the summer that followed, that was the Eric Garner case was big in New York. And then by August, Michael Brown was murdered in St. Louis. And then for me, that was like a rupture moment. And I reached out to folks in St. Louis. I left my job, I left my family, I left my apartment, I packed my things, and I embedded in St. Louis, you know, soon after the uprising began. And what I realized then was that the power to be able to shift the overall conditions in our culture and our society, that is the unique power of social movements. And then everybody has to respond, including capital, including the political class. And so I really leaned into that social movement moment and helped to catalyze the movement for Black Lives to be a what became an international movement. And then I learned about another sort of limitation, right? Which is that social movements, when they're at their best, they're able to surface contradictions that we hitherto have ignored or just baked into our society so we don't look at them or we're not curious about them, like the extrajudicial killing of Black people, or we've grown numb to them, and also call really big questions at the scale of the entire society. So everybody has to wrestle with the contradiction and everybody has to begin to be curious about what the answer to the question was. And at that scale, at the scale of the whole society, all types of things begin to happen that otherwise wouldn't happen. And some of these hard and fast political rules begin to kind of shift, or you realize that they aren't static. However, I learned about another limitation. Social movements can call questions, social movements can surface contradictions, but in some ways, social movements produce a crisis. And what I've learned about crisis is that the most organized forces are able to best make meaning of the crisis and best leverage that crisis. And again, it's like the most organized forces in our society are organized capital. And so what I witnessed was us calling for a reckoning around hundreds of years of deprivation and hundreds of years of anti-Black racism and structural violence. And the answer was a product. Taser International, who now is called Axion, they produced body cameras as the solution. And they already had the capacity and organization to be able to lobby for body cameras all the way at the White House and in every single jurisdiction. And we live in a world now where body cameras are ubiquitous and that corporation has made a killing. And the killings of Black people continue. And that ultimately is what brought me to that, and Donald Trump's election is what brought me to this realization that it's not just elections, but what we need is a political party, because political parties organize all of those things, all of the different pieces of the puzzle that I learned had a lot of value but had limitations. Political parties are a shared political commitment that movement forces, grassroots organizations, labor institutions, talking heads on TV, donors, voters, elected officials all choose to align around. Political parties are a center of gravity. And so it's not, the question really isn't, are elections an effective tactic or should we engage in elections? I think we should, or are protests an important tactic? And should we engage in protests? I think we should. But we have to recognize that there are limitations to all these things. And all these things are tactics. And what we need is a shared political commitment and a shared strategy to nest these tactics in, to be reflective about the limitations of those tactics, and to understand that we're not in a hermetically sealed environment, that we have actors who are constantly going to, even if we have successful tactics, we're going to learn from those tactics and then respond. And that's what brought me to the Working Families Party as a way to nest together my learnings from grassroots organizing, for movement organizing and electoral organizing, and to be able to appraise everybody in the ecosystem of the strengths and limitations of all of these tactics and these different, what they are different fronts in a multi-front war that includes the culture war and everything else. And we need coherence in order to engage in a multi-front battle for our democracy. Coherence that I think the far right has been able to develop over several decades.
That's great. And I just want to dig into that point a bit deeper. You're talking about how you understood the moment as a key moment to engage and build in a party. And in our book, we talk about to develop good strategy, you really have to have a clear, sober assessment of the conjuncture, the political moment. So can you say a bit more about how you read this particular moment? How are the forces of the left and the right, the underdogs and the overdogs aligned? And what is the strategic task for this moment?
Sure. You know, I think about this a lot, and I think it's really helpful for us to engage this question, because if we don't, it's kind of hard to understand why things are happening the way they're happening. So I'll take the Supreme Court, for example. And we live in a world where the Supreme Court is at its lowest in terms of people's confidence in it. It is like almost nakedly showing up to be deeply corrupt. The right wing of the Supreme Court is not even pretending to engage in some sort of coherent theory that is above politics. It's just kind of like being used as a political instrument. But how did we get there? You can't understand where we are now without understanding us as being more than 40 years outside of the neoliberal experiment, and also more than 40 years outside of a very thoughtful billions of dollars of investments in right-wing infrastructure in order to uphold that experiment. And some of that infrastructure includes the leadership development infrastructure that was put in place in order for a very unpopular set of actors who understood that their ideas weren't popular, they understood that they needed to have a bulwark against popular opinion. And so they invested heavily in being able to commandeer the courts, right? And so all the activity that the pro-democracy forces are playing as it relates to the courts right now, like the pro-democracy forces are like 40, 50 years behind, right? And so, you know, when you think about, for example, public opinion, if you just look at public opinion as a snapshot, for example, how most everyday people are feeling about the economy, when you look at that snapshot, you might be perplexed. Well, Bidenomics just produced like 13 million, 14 million jobs, and unemployment is below 4% and inflation is below 4%. Why is there such a disconnect in terms of public opinion as it relates to the economy? To me, one of the answers is like the conjuncture. The current state of capitalism is we're under a neoliberal economy, which has divested from the commons over 40 years. So in the 70s, one of the things that we're able to absorb some of the economic shocks that individual people and communities might experience, what was a much more robust commons where maybe they weren't perfect, but there was a public mental health system. And if you were a regular person, you could go to public college for free or for very, very low cost and not suffer under debt. And a lot of the systems that have been privatized over the past 40 plus years were part of the commons. And so that is a significant difference in people's experience of their community and of their economy. The second thing is, over 40 years, a pretty elaborate information environment has been developed. And it's almost been a one-sided information environment developed for the purposes of either capital or for the narrow economic and ideological purposes of the right wing, right? And so people are either getting their information from a corporate media, and by corporate, I mean like the stuff that you could talk about is pretty limited, or right-wing media, or more and more people are getting their information from social media and the unique way that algorithms are serving individuals, which means there's less of a shared information environment, for better or worse, and less of a shared culture. And so there's an atomizing of individuals, and that atomization is a political project, is an ideological project of neoliberalism. So we're 40 plus years into this experiment that has transformed our politics, it's transformed our economy, it's a system of logic, and it's also transformed how individuals understand themselves in relationship to others and in relationship to their communities. So we're less part of communities now because of this ideological project. And as a result, very recently, the Surgeon General says that we're in an epidemic of loneliness. We shouldn't be surprised, right? We shouldn't be surprised that people are feeling deeply alienated, lonely, disconnected, because we were taught that all you needed to do was worry about you and your 2.2 kids and your house in the suburbs. And, you know, Margaret Thatcher famously said, there is no society, there are just individuals. Like, this is the byproduct of living in that philosophy. And so when I think about the particular moment, I think about the past 40 years and even the past almost 80 years and the different swings and the different shocks, but also the different stages of the political economy and how we're all sort of swimming in all of that.
Maybe one quick follow-up for you on that, Maurice, is how do you read the authoritarian turn in American politics and the threat to democracy? And does that represent some kind of departure or break? And what shifts, if any, does that mean for progressives in terms of strategy?
Sure. Well, I think the logic of neoliberalism has collapsed. And there's been a crisis of legitimacy as it relates to this neoliberal idea, which at one point, again, was just considered the only way. In fact, many people theorize that it was the end of history, meaning that there were no more needs for any big ideas. Like, this is how we were going to run things from here on. After the end of the Cold War, that we might live in like a world where it's not a multipolar world where there's just one superpower, there's one economic system. This is it. We figured it out. Clearly, that's not what happened. And so in this crisis of legitimacy, you know, I often say that nature doesn't like vacuums, power doesn't like vacuums. So there's a crisis of legitimacy where people all around the world are recognizing and aren't talking in these terms, aren't saying like, oh, the neoliberal experiment has become delegitimized, but recognize that the deal that was given to them, that deal is no longer working and that people are suffering. People no longer feel like they could protect their families, they can put food on the table, they can make ends meet. People are feeling a sense of physical and economic precarity and insecurity all around the world, just everyday working people all around the world. In that environment, it's actually a perfect environment for authoritarians to be able to fill that gap. So we're seeing a spate of right-wing populists who are actually challenging neoliberalism. They're offering a challenge to neoliberalism, and they're offering a solution that is moving us further to the right, that is less democratic. But everyday people are looking for urgent solutions to this crisis of legitimacy, are looking for urgent solutions to meet their material needs, but also to meet their psychic needs. I strongly believe that people have a need for dignity. People have a need to feel secure. And what right-wing authoritarians and fascists and others are offering is a pretty consistent story that is very attractive. What they're saying is you should believe your eyes and ears. The system that you were told will provide prosperity, will keep you safe, that system is not working. And the people that said that have lied to you. Not only have they lied to you, they told you those lies so that they could rob from you your dignity. If you're a man, for example, your ability to protect your family, and rob from you what is entitled to you. And not only do they rob from you, but they give to others. They give to immigrants. They give to people who are not deserving. They give to whoever the boogeyman is. Work with me. Take my hand so that I can help you protect your family. That sounds like a pretty good deal for a lot of everyday people, and one of the reasons why right-wing authoritarianism has become so popular to so many people. And on the other hand, in a lot of cases, the pro-democracy forces, which might include people on the left, are often led by this center-right coalition of people who upheld the neoliberal consensus. And they're still trying to, instead of recognizing that these ideas have lost legitimacy, some of them are still trying to to hold on to it. What they're saying is different. They're saying things will get better. You know, the right wing starts with like things have never been worse. So they're saying things will get better. Work with me in order to protect democracy, in order to protect the system. What the right wing is saying, work with me so that you can protect your family. It's a very different message. And one of the reasons why I'm so concerned, one of the reasons why I'm committed to building the Working Families Party, because we need a presence in the American democracy that is offering a solution to everyday people that is as attractive and also tracks with their experience as much as the solution that the right wing is offering so many people both here and around the world.
I really love that answer. And I want to probe a little bit on a tension I think many of us experience, which is the demand by social movements for bold, visionary changes in society. And then in the context of electoral coalitions, kind of the need to hold them together and to command majorities. So that has played out around issues like defund, immigration, many, many issues. I'm just curious, what's your state-of-the-art thinking about how to navigate those realities and tensions?
I think they're very healthy tensions. And just to take a few steps back, it isn't our job to somehow fully resolve tensions. We're always going to wrestle with some contradictions. Our job is to choose the contradictions that we've decided that we want to wrestle with, and then to manage them so that we can move forward, but not to completely resolve them. And one of these tensions, the tension that you just articulated, is one of those tensions. It will never be completely resolved. And that's a good thing. We want to make tensions generative. And so one of the reasons why I do the work that I do, coming from social movements, right? Like, I'm one of the activists that during the election cycle helped to organize what I thought was a very effective direct action against Hillary Clinton, where an activist was in a closed door fundraiser in the South, and the activists presented Hillary Clinton with statements that she made about super predators, right? And she had to like wrestle with that, right? So I'm a big fan of social movements, social movement pressure, direct action. And I just think it's a question of role, right? And it's a question of the, like in social movements deal with a whole set of contradictions that are unique and are different from the contradictions that folks who are attempting to win elections, right? And the reason why I'm so, I guess, obsessed with building a shared political commitment and I'm obsessed with party building is that I think that in that organizing lies a solution to that. So ideally, you will have a self-aware party or a self-aware shared political commitment that includes social movements, labor institutions, candidates, and a political party that is involved in ensuring that that movement could govern, working together. And then what it might look like are social movements articulating demands and language that is pushing the realm of the politically possible and creating I think we're seeing it right now, right, with the ceasefire demand, for example. There are social movement actors that are engaging in popular protests that are keeping the demand in the news, that are an invitation to more and more people to engage in that demand and are applying pressure on people on the inside, right? The people on the inside are not going to use the same language or use the same tactics as the people on the outside. But then there's a whole set of people who are organizing inside of the White House, right? And also organizing on the Hill in order to figure out how the United States could actually help get to a political resolution. Another example that I saw was during the moment around policing, right? There were people in social movements that were making demands that were not majoritarian demands. That's what they should be doing. And then there were elected officials who had relationships with those social movements, like Tajara Jones, who won as mayor of St. Louis, and eventually Brandon Johnson, the mayor of Chicago, who articulated a very different position that was aligned. It was an aligned position that was different. Brandon Johnson was talking about the investments that actually make us safe and how we need to lean in investment in mental health, investment in youth jobs, if you want a safer city. And that is different than some of the demands that the folks in social movements were engaging with, but they weren't opposed necessarily. And getting Brandon Johnson in a governing, winning and governing the city of Chicago meant that those social movement actors, they still were going to push the boundaries. They are still likely going to challenge Brandon on a bunch of things, but you have an administration that is now amenable to the investments necessary in order to, outside of the police, in order to actually create a safe city, right? And so that tension, I think, is managed through building relationships, through people in the different divisions of labor being part of a shared political commitment, and through the natural trust building that that struggling together creates. And I think you're able to do that when you're part of a self-aware party or part of a self-aware long-term political commitment. You're able to see the value of people who are in different lanes. When you're not part of that self-aware commitment, then you could look at people's tactics in different divisions of labor with a lot of, I think, undue concern or skepticism, right? It's like people in different divisions of labor have different ministries and have different audiences. And just like in a social movement environment, you don't have to worry about majorities. As somebody who's running for election, you have to worry about majorities and you have to govern everybody, including the people who disagree with you. Those are different set of tactics, different prerogatives, but hopefully for the same long-term political goals.
Great. Thank you. And so going along that, around this idea of building a party, one of the challenges is really thinking about governing in a serious way. And, you know, so much of the critique of politics as usual is like all this money and time on elections alone with far less attention to the strategy of governance. And so I think one of the things that you all as Working Families Party is taking very seriously is working with candidates once elected in this notion of co-governance and then being really serious about what governing might look like. So can you say a bit more about that?
Sure. So at WFP, we don't obsess over elections. We obsess over governing, right? And so elections are a means to the end of governing. And all political parties, like that's the purpose of any political party. If you're a large political party, if you're a minor political party, the reason you wake up every day as a political party is to be in a governing position. And so for us, when we're talking internally about it, you know, there's a lot of talk about co-governing. I actually feel like co-governing, what makes that conversation interesting to me is not the co-governing part, because I believe that for the most part, elected officials know how to co-govern pretty seamlessly, and they do it all the time with the real estate lobby and with the pharmaceutical lobby and with organized capital. It's just, they don't even think about it, but it's just kind of the way of doing business in Capitol Hill and in various state capitals around the country. What I think is really exciting and what's emerging is this field of what it looks like to co-govern with the people, to co-govern with your constituents. And what we've been practicing and experimenting with is what that looks like. So I talked about Philadelphia and the at-large city council seats. So we just had an election where we rendered the Working Families Party the second party in municipal governance. And Kendra Brooks was elected in 2019 in that at-large city council seat. Many people were wondering, well, what would it mean to just have one Working Families Party person as an at-large city council person? How would Kendra Brooks really get anything done? And what she's been able to do, she's been able to organize with Democrats that are progressive and really lead on a number of pieces of pretty substantial legislation. Because we're in a governing posture, we supported Kendra in thinking creatively about what it looked like to be in relationships with the other folks in the city council and caucus with them and strategize with them. We're not interested in winning elections so that our candidates could just be gadflies and so that we could just be marginalized in the city council or in Congress or in state legislatures. We actually want the prize. And we're learning what that inside-outside game looks like. What it looks like is actually telling ourselves a different story than the story that I talked about before that I was raised in, which is elected officials are the target, right? What we say at Working Families Party is that no, it actually depends. Some elected officials can and should be our comrades. And that's how co-governing happens, when we actually believe, because if you believe that elected officials are the target, then what you're also saying implicit in that is that we will never have power and that our job is always to petition the people with power. We reject that. We believe that we should have power, that we have the capacity, that we have the skill, that we have the sophistication to lead, and that our ideas should become hegemonic, meaning our ideas should become the common sense. And so every day we're working to that end. And so what we do with Kendra, the co-governing work that we do in Kendra, the co-governing work that we do with people like Greg Kazar, who's a freshman congressperson from Austin, or Delia Ramirez from the Chicago area, another congressperson, or Summer Lee, a congressperson from the Pittsburgh area, we are engaged in a posture of governing with them. So the questions we ask and that they ask is, inside of the Progressive Caucus, how can we organize our friends and our colleagues around a ceasefire? Great. How can we talk to folks in leadership about that, who may not be ideologically aligned with us, but we need to have a relationship with? How do we engage some of the other caucuses? That is a governing posture. And so that looks different than like, oh, we're just going to write message bills and we're not going to be concerned with actually passing things, right? We might write message bills, but that's just one tactic, right? And then if that's true, that means that our side, we have an obligation, the people outside of government that are in this co-governance relationship have an obligation to flank elected officials who we see as comrades and members and give them the space for them to do very bold things. So it's a lot easier to call for a ceasefire when there's millions of people hitting the street day in and day out, for example. So that is, I think, a concrete example of how that co-governance works. It's imperfect, and I like to say that because our side has so little experience governing, you have to crawl before you can walk, you have to walk before you run. And a lot of our co-governance experiments, it's us awkwardly figuring it out as we go. And we're learning a lot in all the different state houses that we have WFP members on Capitol Hill and in the cities where we and our people are in a governing opportunity.
So I want to just shift a little bit here and talk to you about an article you wrote last year around building resilient organizations. And you wrote that piece coming out of a lot of discussion and with other organizations and activists about the challenges many progressive organizations are facing right now, partly due to the stresses of neoliberalism, partly due to a number of external factors and stresses. And I think, you know, you highlighted a number of internal factors that cause stress of tensions for groups to build, as well as some external issues about how do we actually get serious about building power. And I think you named 10 trends that are common in progressive organizations right now. And I'm wondering if you could just speak maybe just about one or two of those that you think are really important for progressive organizations to grapple with.
Sure. I think it's been just a year. This is the year anniversary of that article being released, and the conversations continue. And I could have never have anticipated that it would have been taken up as much as, and I'm pleased, but you know, I couldn't have assumed publishing across three sources that, you know, I read a lot, but I definitely don't think are considered popular sources. I don't think I could have assumed that so many people all over the world in our movement and outside of our movement would be wrestling with these things. So some of the symptoms, I named 10 symptoms. I always am in conversation with folks about neoliberal identity and how our identities, our personal stories, our gender identities or ethnic identities or family stories, that it's our job as people in the pro-democracy movement to leverage those identities and stories so that we could be more open to other people's stories and other people's identities. And so that they can be conversation starters, right? And what I've seen is that, unfortunately, that outside of a clear ideological theory of the case, people are using identity as a cudgel to one up one another or to be able to add some fuel to an argument that maybe won't stand on its own merits, or to, in a narrow situation where you're trying to gain personally, you kind of pull personal story or identity out as like a tool to advantage you. And, you know, I think about the Cohembi River Collective and the framework for identity politics that they laid out for us. And I encourage people to really read and take seriously what they were talking about. They were talking about solidarity outside of their identity and understanding that you needed to come from a strong base from your personal story or your identity in order to make that happen. And our movements, I think, and our organizations are weaker when we're not thinking critically about how to leverage identity for the purpose of building a solidarity movement. So that is something that I continue to see and continue to try to challenge us and call us into. Another thing that I see is like this tension, and it's just a real tension that we have to wrestle with. The urge for us to engage as activists versus us to be part of collective projects and be part of organizational projects. I think the tension is a healthy tension to have, and people are feeling it. I think you feel it most acutely during moments of great contradictions, like, and great moral moments like the ones that we're in, where you as a person feel this desire to express yourself so that history could record where you stood in a particular moment. And if you're doing organizational or collective work, that might be in tension with the need for you to do work inside of a collective. And I think that the tension on one end is the desire for activist voice. And on the other end, it's collective utility, right? And basically, as people are building organizations, we're leaning towards collective utility. And that does require us to stifle some of our activist voice, but for the purpose of collectively being more impactful. And that is a tension that we need to be open about, because sometimes it's viewed as a moral tension, right? I must speak in this moment, which I actually think is like a very like neoliberal sort of prerogative, this need for our, and it's one of the reasons why I feel like we've failed, because we've sort of observed this discourse of individual rights, right? Without recognizing some of the challenges of elevating the discourse of individual rights over everything, it creates the conditions where it's like, if I feel it, I should express it. Rather, like, let me sit in this tension. Like, I do want to express myself, and I also have an obligation to the collective. What do I do in this moment? Which is a much more interesting question than, if I feel it, I must express it. The question of individual voice, to me, is very much inside of the logic of the sort of neoliberal activist that is like a consumer in the activist marketplace, rather than this logic that I think comes from certain political traditions that speak of the work of collectives, of organizations, of movements, in order to show up and be strong enough and be aligned enough to be able to resolve political crises and to be able to make meaning of the political moment.
So Maurice, what gives you hope in these times?
Yeah, I've been asked this question more so over the past month, I think because of everything that's going on in the world and how desperate and hopeless and powerless so many people feel when they're watching the news and they're seeing so much suffering in Gaza, for example, right? I know my dad is such a, like, he is like a news junkie. He's just a news junkie. And I remember I saw him, must have been like 2 weeks ago, and he wasn't watching the news, and I was surprised. And he's just like, I can't watch this, because every time I turn the news on, I think of my grandchildren, and it just saddens me. So what I tell folks, and I do believe this, I think it's really important that we tell people no lies. I think that we have a sacred obligation as leadership and as organizers to tell people the truth. And so I engage in this work not because of some assured victory. We're going to win some and we're going to lose some. We've lost some and we've won some already, and we have more of that in store for us. We have more losses in store for us. We have more victories in store for us. But I would be lying, and I think anybody would be lying, if they claimed somehow that they could assure victory. So that's not what brings me to the work. That's not what energizes me. And then also this question of like being right. I think especially as I've gotten older, that has less resonance for me, because all we're doing is, to the best of our ability, with our limited faculties as humans, trying to make the best calls that we can. And then history ultimately will decide if we were right or wrong, and there'll be debates about it. And, you know, so that's not the entry point for me. The thing for me that allows me to wake up with the same excitement that I've woken up with since I was like a youth activist and campus organizer is this question, and it's a present question that you choose every single day. What are you building? Who are you choosing to be? And who are you choosing to be with? Right? And I get really excited and very hopeful when I think about the project that I'm building, when I think about the strategies that we're building. I get a deep sense of pride and humility and gratitude that I get to choose to be somebody that's on the freedom side. And then lastly, who I'm choosing, the fact that I get to choose the dignified and beautiful and complex working people of all races across this country to be in struggle with, that is such a gift. And by choosing a set of people, you're choosing in times of great loss who you get to comfort and who comforts you, and at times of victory, who you get to celebrate with. And I can't think of a greater and a more honorable choice.
That was a beautiful answer. And I think we all needed to hear it today. Maurice, thank you so much for this interview, but just for your soulful leadership in the world. We so need it.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
I'm so inspired by Maurice's ability to be realistic about the challenges involved in contesting for governing power in the country while insisting that we have to keep trying. I think his point that we have to move from only trying to win elections to building organizations is critical. Some of the groups we write about in the book, like California Calls, are combining community and electoral work, but for Maurice, it's crucial to have an actual political party, even if that party looks quite different from state to state. Since there have been quite a few efforts to build political parties in the past, we need to be honest and realistic about what they faced and what we can learn from those experiences.
Right, and I like how Maurice is so clear on the necessity of electoral work despite the challenges, because it isn't a question of whether or not to engage in electoral work, but under what conditions is it most strategic? Under what conditions can it help us move towards the world as it should be, both by building underdog organizations and capacity and by blocking overdogs from their attempts to govern?
Overdogs take governing power very seriously, and we can learn from them what it looks like to invest in electoral strategy. You can see that in their multi-decade effort to take over courts and school boards, as well as their detailed plans like Project 2025, an extensive plan to transform government should Trump win the White House in November. We offer a few tools in Practical Radicals designed to foster strategic debate about electoral work. One of those, Tool 36, is called the Long-Term Agenda, and it comes from the Grassroots Power Project. The tool asks you to think about the structural reforms needed to actually transfer wealth and power in our society, and then work backwards in stages to the kinds of fights you would need to get there.
Tool 21, Strategic Debate, provides a way to have a healthy, productive debate within your organization. It's a tool that can be used in a variety of ways, but fundamentally it rests on building the muscles and trust to challenge one another to get sharper on our strategy. Our organizations often fall into either accepting all ideas for fear of hurting someone's feelings or shutting people down altogether. Strategic debate is a place to present ideas, challenge one another, and come out stronger as a result. Our colleague, Christina Jimenez, told us about a tool called Strategy Idol, based on the TV show American Idol, where teams present their strategy to a team of judges drawn from their colleagues. The concept here is to develop the muscles to do this kind of strategy work with both creativity and rigor, and to have some fun along the way. We need to think about electoral change work in the span of decades, not just election cycles. Underdogs are nowhere close to achieving governing power, so it is going to take many, many years of work to get where we need to go.
That's all for this week's episode of Practical Radicals. Please check out our book, Practical Radicals, 7 Strategies to Change the World, available wherever books are sold. And if you enjoyed the show, please help us spread the word by liking it on social media, giving us a good rating, and even writing a review. You can also learn more in the show notes about Leadership for Democracy and Social Justice, the training institute for early and mid-career organizers based at CUNY that Deepak and I helped to start.
In our next episode, I'll be speaking with Felicia Wong, president of the Roosevelt Institute. We'll be talking about inside-outside campaigns, which are a way to win big policy changes that can change people's lives. Felicia makes meaning of her experience helping to shape the Biden agenda over the last 4 years.
What are the kinds of policies that will really show up in people's lives such that more people would continue to demand them? And so as we build these kinds of policies going forward, movements need to make sure, media needs to make sure that the narrative is, you know who brought that to you? Movements brought it to you because they demanded it, and government brought it to you because they made it happen.
Practical Radicals is made possible with support from the Roosevelt Institute. Harry Hanbury and Peter Kakoma produced the series, and Peter Kakoma is the series editor. Our theme music was composed by Christian Perez-Yates and performed by Trio Gafas. Additional music was by Christian Perez-Yates and Peter Kakoma. Join us next time for more practical and radical strategies to change the world.